listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So Mark Salzman's books include the memoirs Iron and Silk, True Notebooks, and the novel Lying Awake. I'm going to keep this introduction very short because I know we all want to get to the performance. But I just want to say that Mark is really a writer who's able to take us with him on his journeys of discovery, indecision, crisis, and revelation. He's a writer who asks big questions, and he has a very big heart. His new memoir, The Man in the Empty Boat, is the story of his year in the emotional wilderness and his attempts to find calm. So tonight he's presenting it as a monologue, and you will be here. You know, this makes it one of those very special Aloud performances which you won't see anywhere else. We are so thrilled to welcome Mark Salzman back. It's been 12 years since he performed here with his cello, and we are just delighted. So without further ado, please welcome Mark Salzman. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming on a Thursday night. It's so good of you. I just want to explain, I'm a little overdressed. It is a spur-of-the-moment thing. The deal is that this tuxedo I bought in 1989 for my wedding, you know, to get married in, and that worked out pretty well. But I haven't had many opportunities to wear it since, and I think that's a real pity. Now, last night, we were having dinner to celebrate my wife's birthday a little bit late, and what she wanted for her birthday was she wanted to have dinner at the Magic Castle in Hollywood. You know, this place, private club for magicians, and well, she knows a magician who got us an invitation, so we went. And before we went, I saw there's a dress code, elegant attire. It says, gentlemen must wear jacket and tie. I only have one sport jacket and one tie that I bought, I want to say at Trader Joe's, but at Target. And and I'm not very enthusiastic about it. It's not very good looking. And so I said, Jessica, elegant attire. I'm going to wear my tuxedo. And she said, Mark, you can't wear your tuxedo to the Magic Castle. I said, well, why not? She said, well, because there will be magicians walking around, and if people see you in a tuxedo, they'll expect you to perform. So I did not wear my tuxedo. I got up today, this afternoon, I was getting ready for this. I thought, wait a minute, I'm going to wear my tuxedo tonight. And thank you. And I thought, if anyone expects me to perform, well, so no problem. So that's my little tuxedo story. All right. I have a true story for you with a strange but happy ending. And I'm going to begin in the middle. 8 years ago, a musician friend was in town for a concert, and he invited Jessica, me, and our daughter Ava to meet him for dinner at a restaurant in Beverly Hills, fancy restaurant. Now, Ava was just 2 years old at the time, our older daughter. She was always an ideal restaurant baby. All we had to do is we'd stick her in a high chair, give her some paper and some pencils, and she would just draw happily. You never had problems with Ava. And sure enough, that's what happened. We put her in the high chair. And after about an hour of conversation, our friend, noticing that she hadn't squirmed or whined or complained, asked us what we had done to make her so serene and self-possessed. Now, I'm a person who has tried every method known to man to achieve serenity and self-possession, and none of them has worked. So I said, she sure as hell didn't learn it from me. And this led our friend to pose the following question. Since we inherit so much from our parents, including their DNA, and since they play such a crucial role in our upbringing, when do we ever truly grow beyond their influence? When is our authentic self really our own? And at that point, we tossed that back and forth for a while, and our friend noticed then that Ava was staring at him. So he laughed, and he said, well, honey, what do you think? Now, I don't think he expected an answer from the two-year-old in the high chair. I certainly didn't, but she put her pencil down, looked him straight in the eye, and said, you are who you choose to be. Now, the words were not Ava's own. She was quoting a line from her favorite movie, The Iron Giant. What wonderful animated film about a robot that wants to be human, but he was designed to be a weapon, and no one believes, you know, everyone wants to destroy it except for a 10-year-old boy who believes change is possible. And at this wonderful moment, the boy stares up at the robot and says, "You are who you choose to be." All right. Naturally, I was thrilled. I felt the rush of joy that all parents feel when their children say something that makes them appear clever. But at the same time, I felt a twinge of dread. For the first 11 years of being married, I was opposed to the idea of having kids because I was afraid if we did have children, they would turn out anxious like me rather than calm like their mother. And there is no single idea that I can think of more likely to generate anxiety and existential paralysis than "you are who you choose to be." Now, let me provide you with a little background information. If the Salzman family had a coat of arms, it would be a shield with a face on it, and the face would look worried. There is so much anxiety and depression in our background that I think if we were to draw our family tree, it would be a weeping willow. Jessica once said to me, "Mark, you were raised by rabbits." And she's right. Our whiskers tremble when we ponder our uncertain futures. Our claws are useless for fighting. We live in fear. And I'll tell you what we're most afraid of. It's that in the end, it will turn out that we will have spent our lives on a treadmill of worry and wasted effort, and it will be our own fault for not having the brains or the guts to step off it. The best description of this kind of fear that I've ever seen appears on a European existentialist website, where it's offered as a definition for the word anguish. Now, I'm not an existentialist. I found the website by accident. I was looking for pictures, and I typed in the search words French and mysterious, but instead of getting images of Isabel Huppert, I got Jean-Paul Sartre. So here's the definition of anguish they offer. Anguish, a negative feeling arising from the experience of human freedom and responsibility, the inherent insecurity we feel over the consequences of our actions. All right. Anytime we are faced with an important decision where the stakes are high, the consequences are uncertain, and the what may happen if we make the wrong choice might be catastrophic, whenever we're in those circumstances, we tend to feel anxious. And that's a healthy thing. People who feel no anxiety at all under those circumstances usually turn out to be dangerous. But for some of us, the anxiety gets so intense and so persistent and so uncomfortable that it becomes debilitating, and then even trivial decisions can seem overwhelming. Now, this is where the phrase, "have a little faith," would seem to apply, but not all of us have that software up and running. If Godless Universe 4.0 is your operating system, your hard drive may reject most faith-based programs, and there are times when that can seem like a major disadvantage. Okay, now we move to the proper beginning of the story. When I was 13 years old, I was the youngest, shortest, and least aggressive boy in the eighth grade, and I was a cellist in the school orchestra. I was, in other words, a little twerp. But I hadn't chosen to be a little twerp. It was the hand I was dealt, and I wanted a better one. That year, it was 1973, I saw the television show Kung Fu. And I do not exaggerate when I say that by the end of that hour, my life had been changed forever. The main character, Kwai Chang Kane, was someone who had apparently eradicated all traces of insecurity from his central nervous system. He'd also learned how to walk through walls, ignore pain, and kick pistols out of men's hands when the need arose for it. And he played the flute, if you can believe it. He was every little twerp's fantasy come to life. He had something that no one in my family had or had ever had, and that I wanted more than anything else on earth: peace of mind. According to the show, Kwai Chang Kane wasn't born that way. He had achieved peace of mind and learned how to fight really well at a school in China whose entire curriculum was designed to produce graduates who would never again have to experience boredom, frustration, or unhappiness. The school was called the Shaolin Temple. It was a Zen Buddhist monastery, and going there became my dream. And when I told my father this, he said, "Not until you finish high school." If I couldn't go to the Shaolin Temple, I decided to make the Shaolin Temple come to me. I burned lots of incense in the basement. I wore a bald head wig so that I would look like my head was shaved, And I walked to school barefoot every day in the snow in the winter in Connecticut to overcome pain. When my mother heard about the shoes, she was furious. She said, people will think we can't afford shoes. You won't wear shoes. She made me promise to wear shoes, and I did promise, but I cut the soles out of the bottoms of them. Be glad I was not your kid. That's all I can say. I looked up Zen Buddhism in the World Book Encyclopedia, and this is the message I took from there. Life sucks, and then you die, unless you're enlightened. If you're enlightened, life sucks, and then you die, but it's okay. Enlightenment is a highly evolved state of consciousness. If you reach it, all of your problems will be solved at once in a blinding flash, and they will stay solved forever. From that moment on, no matter where you are or what happens to you, you will be at peace. So I dedicated myself to the study of Chinese language, literature, martial arts, and philosophy for 16 years. But instead of turning me into an enlightened sage, this effort succeeded only in turning me into someone who might have been raised by Chinese rabbits. In hindsight, I think I know why. I think I know why it didn't work. Let me share a story with you from the Zhuangzi. This is a Taoist classic written in China about 23 centuries ago. If a man in a boat is crossing a river and an empty boat drifts into his, he won't get angry. But if there is someone in the other boat, then the man will shout out directions to move this way and that. And if his directions go unheeded, he'll shout again and then a third time, followed by a torrent of curse words. If a man could make himself empty and wander like that through the world, who could do him any harm? It's a wonderful allegory, but there's a paradox embedded in it, and anyone who has tried to become enlightened know what it is. Here's the paradox. The harder you try to become empty, the more full of yourself you become. Egotism becomes cleverly disguised when it takes the form of the attempt to become egoless, but the disguise can't change the fact that the desire to become a saint, whether the Buddhist or the Catholic version, is the most egotistical goal of all. Grace is a gift. It's not a prize. You can't make it happen on purpose. If it does happen, it must come by some other means. But I ran out of steam before I could find out what those other means were. Instead, I discovered writing, and that gave me something new to think about for a while. Writing is an ideal occupation for a rabbit. Because it gives you an excuse to stay in your burrow all day and explore problems like anxiety and insecurity without having to solve them. You don't have to have peace of mind to be a writer. In fact, the more trouble you are, the more you have to write about. I had plenty to write about. Writing became my full-time job for 17 years. I wrote 6 books, and then we had kids. How did I go from being opposed to the idea of having children to becoming a stay-at-home dad? The answer is I married someone who was not raised by rabbits. Jessica was raised by child-loving Asiatic eagles. Here's how decisions get made in our house. Jessica researches, she compares, she considers, she decides, and then she tells me what we've decided to do. When she had said that the time had come for us to have children, I raised the white flag and asked for only 2 conditions. I didn't want to change diapers, and I wanted to get an office outside of the house, 5 days a week. I knew I couldn't work and be around kids. I could almost see myself in the old-fashioned dad role, coming home from work at dinner time, reading to the kids before bed, taking them to the zoo on the weekends, but I could not see myself as a modern, involved dad. I'd seen these guys at the farmer's market with baby Bjorn strapped to their chests and defeated expressions on their faces, and it did not appeal. Well, Jessica agreed to these conditions, and I swear this is true. The moment the delivery room nurse handed our child to me and her little hand bumped against my pinky, closed around it, and squeezed, I changed my mind about the diapers, and I never mentioned getting an office outside the house again. At that time, Jessica was getting steady work and was earning more than me, so when we had to figure out how to divide up the parenting, homemaking duties, it was easy. I did not have to volunteer for the job. I wanted the Mr. Mom job, and from that point on, diaper changes, bottle feedings, burping, baths, anything that didn't require nipples, I did it, and it was the best job I ever had. But after about a year and a half of complete immersion in the parenting role, I began to look forward to having little breaks from it. And eventually, I started feeling the itch to write again. So I began work on a novel. And I wrote for an hour every morning before the baby woke up and then an hour during her afternoon nap. Now, that may not sound like much, but I knew it was possible to write a novel this way because I'd read in People magazine that J.K. Rowling had done it. Fuck her. I held to the schedule for a couple of years, but then our second daughter was born, and I discovered that having two kids doesn't double the amount of work a parent has. It squares the amount of work. But I didn't lose hope. After 3 years, I had a finished manuscript. I sent it to my editor. I waited for her ecstatic response. And instead, she sent it back with a long letter listing all the ways that it failed utterly as a narrative. The problems were so extensive that I decided it would be hopeless to try to revise it. I had to start all over. So I created a new main character and plot and wrote another draft from scratch in another 2 years, sent it in, and I got the same disappointing result. I did it a third time. All new characters, all new plot, all new everything different, and the same just catastrophic response got back. So at that point there, I had been working for 6 years on it, I had nothing to show for it, and I'd already been paid in advance. That's when my whiskers began to tremble. J.K. Rowling is a statistical anomaly. Either that or she's not a real person. I think she's a literary hoax. She is invented by a group of English professors at Cambridge who had played Dungeons and Dragons together for 30 years. And one day one said, "I know, let's write a book that every boy on earth will want to read." "Oh, brilliant. Let's say that a single mom wrote it, then women will buy it too." Like my mother, whose career as a concert pianist ended the day I was born, I discovered I couldn't have it all. It wasn't that I had lost the ability to write. It was that I had lost the ability to write well. And that's worse, because if you can't write at all, everyone feels sorry for you. If you can't write well, nobody feels sorry for you. They just wish you'd get your shit together. This is how I explain it to friends, bartenders, anyone who will listen. If writing books is what you do, you're like a chef whose signature dish has to be slow-cooked for years, but has to be finished at high heat for months at a time. Now, the slow-cooking part, you can look after children at the same time, but it was that last stage where the heat goes way up and you can't take your eye off the stove for a minute. That's what I couldn't do and be on call in the nursery at the same time. Although I could certainly appreciate the value of what I was doing as a parent, I had come to understand why my mother kept a bottle of vodka hidden in a shoebox in the closet. I keep mine out in the open because when I need Daddy's little helper, it's all I can do to just unscrew the cap, never mind scrounging through the closet looking for the bottle. And just as I was unscrewing the cap one night, that's when Jessica looked at me from across the dining room table with the girls on either side of her and said, "Mark, our girls need a dog." I have never cared for dogs. I have nothing against them as animals. All animals have a right to exist. It's the barking. Silence, good. Barking, bad. I suggested that we invest in a realistic battery-operated dog puppet. That's how we solved the horse question. You would never guess that the pony in Ava's room isn't real, and we haven't heard any talk about stables or riding lessons since. But no, Jessica insisted, it would not do for our daughters to have a dog puppet when all their friends have real dogs. And it's true. Every family in our school district has a dog. And I know because every one of them barks at me when I take my walk. Now, although I thought I'd been a good sport about pets overall, since marrying, I've shared my house with tropical fish, finches, a parrotlet, a Chinese robin, a cockatiel, 3 cats, and 2 guinea pigs. But I drew the line at dogs. "No," I said, "this is non-negotiable. We will not get a dog." Nothing obstructs Jessica's will because she has never met a problem she couldn't solve. Sensing that my resistance to getting a dog came from the bad impression I'd received from poorly behaved dogs, she researched, she compared, she considered, and then she told me what we had decided to do. We would adopt a pre-trained adult dog from an outfit in North Carolina that caters to clients who don't have the time to housebreak or train a puppy, or couples where one of the members is very enthusiastic about dogs and the other thinks that dogs are, forgive me, butt-sniffing parasites. The husband and wife who own this company prowl the local animal shelters looking for suitable dogs, and when they find one, they work with it for 8 to 10 weeks before delivering it to the new home. And the idea, which is good, is a well-behaved dog is less likely to be abandoned again. Well, Jessica assured me our dog would not chew, it would not dig, it would not chase, it would not jump, it would not sniff human asses or lunge at human crotches. We would give this wonder hound a home, and in return, it would play dead day and night, and everyone would be happy. So that was February of 2009. February of 2009, our dog was selected and scheduled for delivery sometime in May. In March, I woke up in the middle of one night having what appeared to be the symptoms of a heart attack. I ended up in a hospital, and over the next 2 weeks, I was tested for everything from heart valve disorders to brain tumors. But all of the tests came up negative. And in the meantime, I was having these mysterious attacks, heart rate shooting up, way up and all out of rhythm, chest pain, blurred vision, numb arms and legs, and then completely jumbled thoughts. I couldn't speak. Completely jumbled. It was like a snow whiteout conditions. These things came out of the blue with no warning at all, and they didn't seem to follow any pattern at all. They could come when I was walking, when I was reading to the kids, they could wake me out of a deep sleep. One happened when I was in bed. I ended up falling out of bed. It was so sudden. So it's not like I was thinking about things. Just boom. Strangest of all was that the worst of these attacks happened when I tried to meditate. On the 13th day of this ordeal, the attacks were coming every 8 to 10 minutes, and they were so intense I thought I would lose consciousness. So I ended up in the hospital again, and this time, when I described my symptoms and reported I'd been seen by a regular doctor, by a cardiologist, and by an internal medicine specialist, the ER doctor looked at me and said, "Oh, it's simple. You're having panic attacks." "Okay, hold on," I said. "There must be some mistake. Have you Googled me? I'm Mr. Non-Western Philosophy. I've practiced meditation and Tai Chi for 36 years. I have embraced my inner nurturing female and balanced my yin and yang by giving up a career as a writer to become a stay-at-home parent. And besides, I said I'm not afraid of crossing bridges or getting in elevators or public speaking. Suggest something else." Well, he was unmoved by my credentials. He gave me a prescription for 15 tranquilizers and told me to follow up, meaning see a shrink. Well, I went right from that room to the pharmacy, bought the tranquilizers, took one, and 15 minutes later, my symptoms were gone. And I went from there to Vroman's bookstore in Pasadena and bought a book on panic attacks. And to my dismay, the book described my symptoms and my personality with eerie precision. I learned that while panic attacks can indeed be triggered by specific things like, you know, crossing bridges or elevators, they can also come completely out of the blue. They can strike unexpectedly. Those of us who suffer from these spontaneous attacks may function normally under stressful conditions, but when the stress is relieved, that's when all this crazy stuff starts. I guess it's a little bit like the PTSD issue. That's why deliberate relaxation exercises like meditation can make the symptoms worse or trigger the attacks. That's great, I thought. After 4 decades of trying to manage my anxiety through contemplative philosophy, now I found out relaxation can drive you crazy. I wanted my money back. Reading on, I learned that the way to manage the attacks is counterintuitive. If trying to relax doesn't work, you have to stop trying. You have to surrender. You have to get used to the idea that while the symptoms may be extremely unpleasant, they aren't life-threatening. You let them run their course. You stop resisting them. So armed with this knowledge and my 14 remaining tablets of lorazepam, I set out to cure myself of this affliction, and within about a month, I was feeling shaky but stable. The attacks had ceased. Ideally, I would have been able to take it easy for a couple of weeks at least to recover, but that's not how it worked out. Instead, my brother Eric, who lives in Connecticut, called me early one morning in May to say that our sister Rachel, the youngest of the three of us, was in the hospital. She had developed flu symptoms over the weekend and gone to see her doctor, who said, "You know what, you've got pneumonia. You should check yourself into the hospital." So she did. She went right to the hospital there. And they checked her into the ICU because it turned out she had double pneumonia. When they got there, she responded well to antibiotics right away. And after 2 days, they were able to move her then to a regular room. But that night in the regular room, suddenly her condition deteriorated again. They moved her back to the ICU. And that's when my brother called me. He said, "Mark, because my sister has two daughters exactly the same ages as mine," he said, "if there's any way in the world you can come out and help, this would be the perfect time." Well, I mentioned this to Jessica. This is the good thing about being married to an eagle. I mentioned it, and 8 minutes later, she came out of the bedroom with a laptop in her hands. She had booked me a seat on a flight that day to New York and got me a rental car. So I was on a plane within 2 hours. I decided I would offer to stay in Rachel's house and take care of her daughter so that her husband, Daniel, could spend as much time in the hospital as he needed. I figured I could cook for the girls. I could get them ready for school, make sure they did their homework, practice the flute and piano, put them to bed, do their hair, all the things that I usually do. And who could be better qualified for this than me? I had 8 years' experience as a Mr. Mom taking care of two girls. So as bad as the situation was, I drew some comfort from the fact that I could think that at least I was able to offer something to my sister not everybody could offer. Now, what happened next is the one part of this story I truly don't enjoy having to tell. You will not enjoy having to hear. So I'm going to describe it very briefly. The doctors were suspecting that maybe Rachel had caught an exotic virus on a recent trip to Costa Rica, but it turns out that's not what it was. She had entered the hospital with the flu, but on her third day there, she was infected with staph. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's a highly antibiotic-resistant bacteria that's now very common in hospitals, and it spread from her lungs, then to her kidneys, to her liver. And 3 weeks later, she was gone. Her husband, my father, my brother, and I made the decision together to remove her from life support. The hardest part was not having to watch my sister lose her life. The hardest part was having to watch her daughters receive the news. It was a parent's worst nightmare, and it was exactly what I'd feared most when I first thought about having children, that I might have to see children that I cared about deeply suffer and not be able to do anything to relieve their suffering. The day after Rachel died was her oldest daughter's 9th birthday. And Rachel had organized a party for her at the house. Now, this had all happened so fast, none of us had that in mind. It never occurred to any of us to think about what to do about that. We didn't even know who'd been invited. So I called a grief counseling center in that area, an emergency call. I said, "Help me out here. What do we do?" And the director of this place, he was so wise, he said, "Look, ask your niece what she wants. Some kids want normalcy at a time like this, so ask her. If she wants the party, have the party. But if she doesn't want it, don't make her have it, thinking that'll cheer her up." So I asked her that day, "Do you want the party?" And she was adamant. There was no question in her mind. She wanted the party. And so the next day, I had to stand at the end of the driveway, and as each little guest in their little party suits came down the driveway with their parents, I had to tell them, "Isabella's mother died yesterday." And you can imagine what the reaction was. I said, "Look, we will understand if you not feel comfortable coming, but Isabella wants you to be here, and we would appreciate if, you know, of course." Everyone came, and it turned out it was the best thing we could possibly have done. Daniel, my brother-in-law, is a very handy guy. He's an immigrant from Romania. He escaped during the Ceausescu regime. This is a guy who came here with a dime in his pocket. He can do anything. He had built an Italian pizza oven in the backyard. So what he did that day was he helped all the kids and all the parents make their own pizzas. He fired that thing up. He was busy all day. And it turned out that Rachel had invited one of those animal exhibition outfits to show up. So all of a sudden a van came and people came out of it with reptiles. And they moved into the house and they finished their show with a frog jumping contest in the house. And there was a moment where I was standing in the doorway between the living room and the kitchen. And in the living room were all these children, including my nieces, just laughing hysterically, cheering on their frog as these amphibians are flopping around the little living room. And in the other room were all the adults sobbing. It was the human condition, the best and the worst, under one roof. When I came home from that experience, I'd been away for more than a month, and as you can imagine, I was very eager to see my own wife and kids. They picked me up at the airport and took me home, and I will give you a heads up here. At this point, the story takes an abrupt turn toward the absurd. Can you guess who greeted me in the front yard? Right. Our new dog had arrived 2 weeks earlier and had settled in. She stood ready to defend her territory against intruders. And as far as she was concerned, I was an intruder. Her reaction upon seeing me was to explode in a series of ear-splitting alarm barks and to scurry back and forth in what can only be described as a fight-and-flight response. She could, as promised, obey 12 commands in Dutch and German, but the one command she'd apparently never mastered in any language was, "Shut the fuck up." Dog people tell me she looks like a gigantic West Highland White Terrier and that she's beautiful. She's shaggy and white and has one blue eye and one brown, leading Jessica and the girls to name her Bowie, after the rock musician David Bowie, who also has different colored eyes, whose music, by the way, I've never liked. I would describe myself as a mild-mannered guy, and I doubt that anyone would argue with that description. I've got my issues, but up until that day, anger had never been one of them. But the sight and sound of that 50-pound, four-legged burglar alarm telling me to get off her property really pissed me off. All my pent-up grief, frustration, stress, it all turned into anger, anger like I had never felt before, and I didn't need a doctor to tell me it wasn't healthy. And I couldn't show it. This was my daughter's dog, and they loved it. The last thing in the world I needed right then was for my daughters to be upset with me because I didn't love their dog. "Daddy, do you love Bowie? Do you love Bowie?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah." "Do you love Bowie?" "Yeah, yeah." "You don't look like you love Bowie." "Yeah, I love Bowie." So I went into my room and I lay down until I stopped shaking. But from that day on, whenever the doorbell rang, whenever a car came down the driveway, whenever the UPS guy came, that dog would blow up. And every time the dog blew up, I wanted to kill it. The most impressive display of barking came a few days after I came home when Ava, my daughter's guitar teacher, came over for the weekly lesson. Kevin is as soft-spoken and mild-mannered as you will ever meet. He's also African-American. I learned that day that when our dog sees a black guy, she goes ballistic. Tell me what's wrong with this picture. Dark-skinned music teacher arrives for the lesson. Trained dog from North Carolina goes apeshit. Mortified white owner struggles to control the dog by issuing commands in German. "Boy, nein, Fuß, Zita, Zita, nein, Fuß." Oh, God! I came undone that summer. Every morning I would get up before dawn and I would sit out in the backyard and think, "Today will be a good day." And then the dog would bark, and the chaos familiar to any parent raising young kids would begin. We would run out of milk. I'd open a cupboard. It would be swarming with ants. The kids couldn't find their shoes or the brush that doesn't pull or the braids, whatever. By 10 o'clock every morning, I thought I couldn't stand another minute of it, but there was still 10 hours to go till bedtime. And when finally bedtime arrived and I had given the last cup of milk and tucked the last and sung Raindrops and Roses and Somewhere Over the Rainbow the last time and finally put them in bed, when I wanted to do nothing more than get into bed myself, I still had to walk Bowie and watch her get into that hunching posture and then scoop up her feces with my hand in a little bag. Jessica could see I was in trouble. One day in early August, she said to me, "Mark, I have an idea. It's been years since you've had time to yourself. Why don't you drive up to Idaho? I'll take care of the girls. You can go up there for 10 days, then I'll fly up with the girls and we'll all drive home together. We have a friend with a guest house up there," so I called him, asked him if I could use it for a couple weeks. He said, "Yes." But here's the thing. I knew I couldn't relax up there, knowing that Jessica would be working full time, taking care of the girls and taking care of the dog all at once. She had just been doing that for a month while my sister was dying. And although Jessica never, ever, ever complains about anything, I knew that it wasn't easy, and I didn't want her to have to do it more. So, believe it or not, I offered to take the dog with me. I tried to see it as a positive opportunity. I thought, maybe if it's just me and the dog somewhere quiet, where no one ever rings the doorbell. This house, no one delivers mail to it. There's a community post office box a mile away. No one ever comes there. Phone never rings. I thought, and where I'm not having to be a stalled writer and grieving brother and stay-at-home dad all at once, maybe we'll both calm down. And maybe we'll both just have time to settle. And maybe we'll bond the way we're supposed to. Isn't that the way it's supposed to work? The curmudgeon and the dog? So I drove to Idaho with Bowie in the car. And once we got up there, the house was so quiet that she seemed perfectly content to sleep all day. And that's pretty much what we both did. She would sleep curled up on the floor. I sat in a chair and drank and stared out the window and passed out. And for 4 days, that's all we did. And you know what? I did start to relax. I felt more cheerful than I had in months, maybe even years. On the fifth day, Bowie was curled up at my feet, and I was jotting things down in a notebook. When suddenly she sat up, and it was a wood floor, and I could hear her nails. It sounded like. And then she started to teeter. And then she did something so odd, I had no mental context for it whatsoever. She launched her torso upwards, stood up on her hind legs and rump, with her front paws extended in front of her, then went stiff as a board, teetered like that for a moment, then went backwards like a felled tree, and landed on her back with all four legs sticking straight in the air. It was such an absurd parody of death that I wondered for a moment if that's what it was. Had her former owners, while they were cooking methamphetamine or whatever they were doing, had they taught her this trick, like, play dead, before they dumped her off at the pound? Only when she flopped over to one side and I saw that vomit was pouring out of her mouth did I realize that something was wrong. Now, for a moment, I found it difficult to accept that this was really happening. All of it, beginning the whole scenario, starting with my not wanting the dog to being kind of strong-armed into getting one, the dog arrives during a tragedy, and then my reaction is so out of proportion, and now this preposterous medical emergency. And this after not one, but several of my friends had said to me before I left on this trip to Idaho, you better take good care of the dog, because if anything funny happens to her, it's going to look mighty suspicious. I mean, what? Can you imagine me calling home and saying, you know, angry dad takes Bowie, the barking dust mop, 1,000 miles away to relax. Girls, you won't believe it. She just stood up and died. I got Bowie to an animal clinic fast, where the vet said that it appeared she'd had either a stroke or a seizure, or possibly been bitten by a poisonous insect, hard to say. Normally, well, he said she might recover fully and never have another event, or she might recover and be paralyzed, or the seizures could become intractable, or she might die in the next few minutes. Again, hard to say. Normally, he would have kept her for 24 hours observation, but his daughter was getting married that evening. He was just about to leave. He couldn't take her. He said, you're going to have to take her back with you. Keep an eye on her tonight. And he said, if she has another event, there is an animal hospital in Haley, 10 miles to the south, and they have a 24-hour, you know, clinic. So I took Bowie back with me to my friend's house. And by then, I did feel sorry for her. I did not have the heart to make her sleep downstairs. I put her little doggy bed at the foot of my bed and sat up with her. And I tried to get to sleep, but I couldn't. There was something, she was panting, and the sound of her breathing reminded me of the sound of my sister, panting, gasping for breath, and that inspired a chorus of dark thoughts that I couldn't control. And by midnight, I realized I was going to have a panic attack, and there was nothing I could do to stop it, so I turned on the light and just waited for it to hit. But just at the moment when it would have hit, something unexpected happened. Bowie broke wind. It wasn't a little toot. It sounded as if a 300-pound man had sat down hard on a 50-pound fur-covered whoopee cushion that had been pumped full of methane. My first reaction was to feel annoyed. I thought, can't I get a break? I'm having a nervous breakdown. Could you fart somewhere else? But then I remembered it wasn't Bowie's fault. Dogs don't fart on purpose. And then she did it again. And I had to laugh. The whole thing was so ridiculous. This was the soundtrack to my personal crisis, a farting terrier. And that's when the idea struck me that changed the way I feel about dogs. Here's the idea. Bowie is an empty boat. Now, I didn't mean that Bowie is a mindless object, like the battery-operated horse in Ava's room. What I meant is that Bowie's mind operates as spontaneously as her bowels. Her moods, her intentions, and her actions are determined by circumstance, just as an empty boat's movements through the water are determined by circumstance. The fact that she's a dog explains why she chases squirrels and licks her own butt. She's a terrier. Yap, yap, yap. She was abandoned, which explains the separation anxiety. She was probably mistreated by a man, which explains why she freaks out whenever a man enters her territory. In any case, when Bowie barks, freaks out, or farts, she's not exercising what you and I would call free will. She's not morally responsible for what she does. She can only do what, in some sense, she must do under the circumstances. And here's the feel-good part. If she's always doing what she must, then for all practical purposes, that's the same as saying she's always doing the best she can. And as soon as I thought of her in that context, my annoyance vanished. And then she farted a third time. And that's when I had the idea that changed the way I feel about humans. And here it is. The dog's not the only empty boat in this room. Count me in. Now, I realize that it's not the sort of epiphany that gets a person elected to public office. If Winston Churchill had said, "We're all empty boats," instead of "We shall never surrender," England probably would have gone the way of Poland and France. The conventional view of human freedom and responsibility, you are who you choose to be, destiny is a matter of choice and will, this view appeals strongly to a lot of people, and for good reason. If you are who you choose to be, you're powerful indeed, and most people would rather feel powerful than weak or helpless. And choice obviously plays an important role in everyone's life. Consistently good choices lead to better outcomes than consistently bad choices. That's a fact. It gets confirmed every day. So how could anyone take the alternative view, you aren't who you choose to be, seriously? As I attempt to answer this question, please keep in mind that, one, I am not a credentialed philosopher. Two, I wore a bald head wig in high school that was probably too tight. And three, I owe my life-changing insight to a gassy dog. I'm just saying. Most of us feel, or want to feel, we are the authors of our life narratives. We love hearing stories about people who achieve greatness through perseverance and effort rather than mere good luck or even natural talent. These stories confirm our belief that a fully realized human being is a human being who creates his or her own destiny. He may have started out in life following a script that was composed by DNA or the way his parents raised him or culture and all of that, but at some point, the balance of power shifted. He took control, and now he's composing the script as he goes along. This author metaphor has a lot to be said for it, and when it works beautifully. But the downside is that if you believe that you and you alone are responsible for creating your own destiny, the insecurity you may feel over the consequences of your actions and choices may become so acute that you can hardly bear to act or choose at all. There's a great story, I don't know where it's from, you probably all heard it, that if you take a 2x4 and put it on the ground and ask people to walk across it, most people can do it. But if you put the same 2x4 on a scaffold 50 feet above the ground, most people cannot cross it because of the way, you know, the idea of what the consequence of failure would be. The insecurity, as I said, that you feel over these consequences may become so acute you can hardly bear to act or choose at all. And that's when the experience of human freedom and responsibility becomes negative. And that, I believe, is where my anxiety came from. Authorship implies control. I always assumed that because the cognitive events that clearly influence my destiny, Okay, my thoughts, my feelings, my choices. Because these events take place in my mind while I'm conscious, that means that those events must be under my conscious control. That's my assumption. And I want to give you an example. If we bear with me. Will you humor me for a moment? Let's do something together. And this is an entirely private exercise. I'm not going to surprise anyone with it. What I would like to ask you to do with me is bring up two childhood memories and then choose one of them. Make a choice. Choose one of them and hold it in mind for just a moment. And just sort of pay attention to what it feels like to do this. So, two childhood memories, choose one. All right. Now, I can't speak for all of you. I can only say for myself how that happens, but I'm going to describe for you how it happens with me in the hopes that it resonates with you. If it doesn't, if your process is different, forgive me, I'll move on soon. But here's how it works for me. At the point where I give myself the task, childhood memories, I think, you know, childhood memories, my mind goes silent for a moment, and then a memory appears. And then maybe, and then since I know I have to think of more than one, a second one appears. It's not that there's a billboard. All my childhood memories aren't on a billboard where I can then see them all at once and then choose one over the other. It's that when I think childhood memories, one comes up. It's almost like it bubbles up from somewhere. All right, then it's the choice part. Now I have two memories. Now is where the ball is in my court, because now I have them both there. I can see them both. How do I choose one? How it works for me is, what happens is that the memories alternate in the focal point of my consciousness, my attention. I see one clearly, then I see the other clearly. I see one clearly. And then at a certain moment, a tipping point is reached. My attention settles on one. And at that moment, I'm aware of the thought, that's my choice. That's the moment where I take ownership of the choice. That's my choice. But here's the interesting thing. At each stage of that process, the bringing up of the memory and the choice, I can't honestly say that I was in full control of what my mind was doing. Memories appeared and a selection was made. But was my conscious mind the author of that process, or was it the audience for that process? On the night of the farting dog, I became convinced that it's the latter. My sense of authorship or control over what takes place in my mind suddenly felt like an illusion. And it's not that I became a mindless object, like a puppet dangling from strings. It's that my mind suddenly seemed to be operating as spontaneously as I assume Bowie's does, and subject to the same irresistible and unconscious influences, genetics, prior conditioning, past personal history, culture, all of that. Seen this way, it doesn't make sense for me to say that I determine what happens to me or choose who to be. Instead, I find out what happens to me. And here's the feel-good part. If I'm doing what I must under the given circumstances at each moment, like Bowie, then in some sense, I must always be doing the best I can. For a person like me, with my set of dysfunctions, my fears, my worries, that is the antidote to anguish. The idea that not just me, but everyone, we are all doing the best we can, whether we intend to or not, and whether we like it or not, that is my comforting but unverifiable belief. It doesn't mean that I approve of everything that I do or that I won't try to change the things I don't like. I accept that I'm liable for the consequences of my actions, but I no longer claim sole responsibility for them. Now, allow me to present my theory of faith. This is the lovable crackpot section of the talk. I've always been jealous. Scientists, why is it that only they can reduce their ideas to beautiful little formulas? To hell with them. This is my theory of faith. What this means is that, in plain English, okay, anxiety, fear, responsibility. Anxiety is what you feel when your fear of what may happen is amplified by your sense of being solely and personally responsible for the outcome, and is then intensified and multiplied by thinking about it over and over and over and over and over till you get sick. If your sense of personal responsibility, I learned this from my kids now. My kids know more math than I do, and they've taught me that in an equation like this, if you reduce the value of something on this side, correspondingly it. So if your sense of personal responsibility is reduced, the level of anxiety will be reduced. And this is how I think faith works. At least it's how it works for me. If you truly believe that you share responsibility for who you are and what you become with something beyond yourself, greater than your conscious will, a higher power within which your power to choose and act is a local concentration, whether that be God or karma or genes or culture or the law of cause and effect, then the experience of human freedom and responsibility loses some of its terrifying loneliness and urgency. Now, almost 3 years have passed since my epiphany in Idaho. That's my Anderson Cooper. Epiphany in Idaho. Bowie recovered completely from whatever it was that happened to her up there. And although I'll probably never feel about the dog the way my daughters do, she could do a lot worse than to have me as her human companion. I feed her, I walk her twice a day, I toss her bowl, I pet her, and in return she lets me know when music teachers invade our territory. For a pair of empty boats tethered together, we're doing pretty well. My life without free will experiment is ongoing. Jessica says I can believe whatever I want as long as I don't deny the existence of human freedom and responsibilities in front of the girls until they have finished high school. When they do finish high school, here's what I plan on telling them. If believing that you are who you choose to be drives you forward, lifts you up, and places your life in a meaningful, positive context, then by all means, carry on. But if this belief becomes amplified to the point where it drowns all else out and paralyzes you instead of freeing you, then maybe you've got a way of looking at things that's become maladaptive. Seeing myself as an empty boat has not turned me into the Dalai Lama, and it has not unleashed my inner Shakespeare, but it hasn't turned me into a deadbeat either. It's made me unconflicted, and that's a morally neutral achievement. Zen masters are unconflicted, but so are many sociopaths. It can go either way. As for me, being unconflicted has renewed my enthusiasm for life, probably for the simple reason that I'm not so uncomfortable all the time. When Jessica was in labor with our first child and the contractions got really intense, an anesthesiologist came into the room and delivered an epidural injection, the moment the drug took effect, Jessica's face lit up. She looked around the room and said, "I feel like kissing everybody." That's how I felt the night my dog farted. The feeling has lasted, and that's the strange but happy ending. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mark is ready to take some questions from you as he catches his breath, so we'll move some microphones around. There he is. Just raise your hand if you have any. Maybe that was such a complete story, no one has any questions.
Afterwards, as I say, I'm going to be out in the lobby there. They actually have copies of the book, which is published as an ebook. But they do have these little print-and-demand copies, which is just wonderful to see out there. So I'm going to be doing my magic castle thing. I'm going to sit out there, and you're going to come up there, and your money will disappear. So that, that's okay.
Question, are you ever going to go back to the novel that you tried to write three times and see if you can...
You know, I hope so. I hope that someday I can see that there's something in there that really works, because I still, when I think about that material... It was set in the 13th century in Central Asia at the height of the Mongol invasion period. And it just, there's something about it, the main character, even though the main character changed, it was always someone who had spent his whole life preparing to be of service. You know, there was a Confucian official at one point, and then it was a Franciscan monk. Always someone who had spent their whole life preparing to be of service, but then the external world gets turned upside down, and their opportunity to do what they felt called to do is taken away, and they have to somehow make sense of, well, then what becomes if I've done my part, but then the world burns, what is left for me? And I like that kind of problem. I don't know why. So I hope. But
I was going to ask you how that experience changed your writing and your writing work ethic, if you became more driven or less driven, or...
Well, it's changed the way I feel about self-discipline. I'd always thought of myself as a sort of, even though I would always say to people, I don't think of myself as a self-disciplined writer. I think of discipline as being when you do something when you don't want to do it, because you just have this inner strength. Writing for me was never like that. Writing was an itch, a very uncomfortable itch that had to be scratched. And to not scratch it by writing was more uncomfortable than leaving it alone, than doing the work. So if you've got an itch in the middle of your back you can't reach with your hands, you will get creative. You will find a way. You will do something. And that, for me, writing was always, when problems, human problems, unresolved, I'm a little bit obsessive. They would circle in my mind over and over. Writing is my way of trying to digest it, trying to find resolution. It's like, okay, to me, the kind of ideas that get in my head that I have to write through are kind of like music, where I'll give you an idea. Okay, da 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 da. Duh. Doesn't that bother you? It's uncomfortable when dissonance goes unresolved, and that's what writing. However, I always thought that the reason that I didn't write as well as I thought I should, and wasn't as productive as I thought, because I felt I wasn't working hard enough. If only I could find the muscle that you flex that makes it happen consistently, so I would drive myself. At this point now, I honestly believe I'm not in, I don't have that muscle. I don't have control over it, so I'm kind of easier on myself. I wrote this, and that way, and that sort of happened. Right now, I'm not doing a whole lot. Both of my kids have the flu, so I spent all last night listening to So, not a whole lot is getting done at this moment, but I'm hoping. You know what? I got a little story for you. I had a friend when I was 16. He was 16. When he got his driver's license, he was the happiest man in the world. He had a kind of depressing family situation. You didn't want to be in his house. And so when he got his license, every afternoon after school, he would get into his parents' car, which was a beautiful 1964 Austin Healey 3000 sports car. He would get in that thing and drive for an hour in the back roads of Westport, Connecticut, just to blow off steam. Now, being a 16-year-old male, you can assume he was always driving over the posted speed limit. He said to me one day that he noticed something interesting. Whenever he finished these drives, when he came home, the muscles in his ass were sore. And he couldn't figure it out until finally he paid close attention to when he was driving. He realized whenever he went around turns, he instinctively clutched, flexed, tensed the muscles in his buttocks, because he believed that if he held onto the seat with his ass, the wheels would hold onto the road. When he realized that there was obviously no direct connection between the effort and the result, he was able to relax his ass, and the pain in his ass vanished. And I feel that's what's happened with me. Since I no longer see a direct connection between my flailing myself with, why can't I, I'm gonna, that seems pointless to me now. So there's just, less of that.
I teach meditation, and apropos of what you've just said, I'm quite interested to know whether you then applied your meditation techniques to the panic attacks, allowing them, in other words, tried to drop the resistance to them, whether that helped.
Yeah, I'm sure a person could. I have not. I'll tell you what has happened with me. What has happened with me is that ever since this experience now, every day, throughout the day, there are moments where I just space out. The problem with me in meditation was I wanted something from it. I wanted meditation to make me a better person. I wanted it to make me calmer, more wise, more this, more that. So I was result-oriented. So when I would meditate, I would think, okay, first I will count the breaths. Now I will study the koan. Have I passed it? Am I relaxed enough? Have I sat long enough? Am I withstanding the pain? You know what it's, anyone that's done meditation knows this whole deal. It's, yes, you want some. And of course, the whole idea of meditation is to be an alternative to all that. But when you're someone like me, no, you can't help it. You turn it into the very same thing. I'm going to be the best meditator on my block. I'm going to be an expert. People will be jealous when they hear that I've raised. I passed the 10 ox herding pictures of Zen. So I must say, at this point now, I have not sort of gone back to it in any kind of formal way, but it is obvious now that there are times of the day when I just start to feel, you know, like I'm, you know, that sense of just a little too much. I will now stare into space, or I'll lie down, but I don't, you know, there's nothing formal about it. I don't say, okay, now I will look at my breath, nothing. Whatever my mind wants to do, I just assume that's the best I can do. And it's wonderful. Now, the thing is, I think it's important that a person like me not fall into the trap of then claiming, you know what, I found the shortcut. I'm a Zen master. Because the thing is, I don't think that's fair to say. A Zen master is someone who has had an experience within the context of a whole training, a whole culture, a whole this and that. You can't just automatically assume that your experience of relaxation of inner conflict resolution is exactly the same. Because, for example, like I wouldn't say that my personal experience of emptiness is the same as, say, a Carmelite nun's, because I'm not a Carmelite nun. They have a different... So I think, you know, the pitfall a person like me has to avoid is now setting up shop. You know, guess what? You don't need to sit on those little cushions. For some people do. And if you like it, that's great. But if you're someone like me, you just have to get to the point where you allow yourself to know you're never going to be a Zen master. So that's, yeah, that's my thing.
Just to thank you for sharing your story. Towards the end, you were talking about liability versus taking total responsibility, and I'm unclear about what that means.
Well, let me give you an example of what I mean. Responsibility, I think, when we say responsibility, I think what we generally feel is we're talking about someone made a choice and they could have chosen otherwise. Let's take two car accidents, identical sort of circuit, they look the same from the outside. A car is driving along the road, it veers off onto the sidewalk and hits a pedestrian. In one of the accidents, the driver is texting, and so they made the choice to text. And so we hold them responsible. And the other, the person had an epileptic seizure. In the case of the person with the seizure, we may still hold their insurance company liable for damages, but we don't hold them personally responsible. We accept that it was their car, their body was involved, their mind-body organism was involved, but we withhold moral blame. And my theory about liability is that, yes, if I do something that hurts someone, no one else. I can't just say, well, you can't hold me, you know, sorry, it was the best I could do. No, I understand that society, I assume, has to work in this way. We have to hold each other responsible to some extent, liable for the consequences of our actions. But do we say to ourselves, do we add to it the layer of moral outrage, anger that we feel because we believe he could have done anything, but he chose that? And my position is, I'm just not convinced anymore that we have that kind of freedom of choice. I think that at that moment, at another moment we might choose differently, but at that moment, given that person's personality, whole life history, that was just what, there wasn't really a selection there. That was the thing to do. So that's my, you know, liability means you will have to make, okay, another example. If a tree on my property falls down and hits my neighbor's roof, I will be liable for the damages, but no one reasonably would say, that asshole, why didn't he cut down that, you know, why did he grow a tree? So, yeah, so that's what I mean, yeah.
I'm curious to know, of the books you've written, I think I've read most of them, and my favorite is The Soloist. Which is yours?
You know, it's exactly like the question of which of your kids do you like best? I'm sure there must be an honest answer to that question, but I don't have access to it. I honestly feel I love them all. I guess I have to. Maybe it's a defense mechanism, but I can't think in that way. Otherwise, I don't know. It would just be uncomfortable. Oh, I just think of them as little creatures that have been sent out into the world and largely ignored. And so, yeah, I want them to be loved. Yeah.
Given the status of all your spare time, where are you with the cello these days?
Well, after my first child was born, I thought, well, I'm going to keep it up. You know, I'm going to do an hour a day. Well, that didn't last very long. You can't, because with, you know, young kids, you can never predict when you're going to have an hour. An hour is an ocean of time. That's like a four-week vacation to normal people. And so what I started to feel was is that if I didn't have my hour, I started getting upset with myself. Jeez, because you feel your, you know, if you don't practice for a day with a string instrument, you feel it. It starts to crumble. And then I started getting up angry. And then I suddenly thought, you know what? I've done this before. This is not what I should be doing with my time. This should be for enjoyment. If I'm turning it into a chore and it's all about me showing how good I am and I'm maintaining it, even though I'm, you know, got a kid on my hip, it's not worth it. So I said, I'm going to put it in the closet and see what happens. Well, that was 10 years ago. It has not come out of the closet since, and I haven't missed it. So, you know, what can I say? Maybe there will come a time when it comes back. But for now, I feel like the kids, that's my adventure. That's my music. It doesn't have to be all. Maybe it's sometime you go from one to the other.
How are your nieces and Daniel doing today?
But my nieces seem to be doing very well. Every time I see them, they're okay by their temperaments all along. They're just cheerful kids. They're bright and sparkly, and they seem to be doing very well. It's been 3 years now, and they've been doing well in school. They have great friendships. They don't seem traumatized by it. They have, of course, hard times, but every month they go to this grief center and they do little symbolic things. They release balloons. There are the things that they do that I think they enjoy. What I was told by the counselor at that center was, he said, now look, kids are resilient, so you know, with a healthy family, you know, you will see that they're going to be okay, but don't expect it to then be solved forever. He said especially that we should expect that at transition times, like graduation, weddings, things like that, that's when the absence of the mother is going to come up, and they're going to struggle. So I guess, you know, we're all just sort of waiting and, you know, hoping for the best for everybody. But, you know, considering what I would have imagined it would be like, it's a whole lot better than that. So, yeah.
Thank you, first of all. My least favorite children's book is The Little Engine That Could. I hate that book. And the reason I hate that book is sort of wrapped up in your conversation with your wife about what you tell your children are personal responsibility. Do you agree with her, or is this just keeping your marriage happy, that your children should not know that they are responsible for very little about what happens in their own lives?
Here's the deal. My wife is so different, has completely different perspective than I do. My wife is a person who I honestly think, as far as I know, has never experienced self-doubt or self-loathing. She's just one of those lucky people that seem to have been born with ballast. I mean, you throw her in any storm, well, her boat gets tossed, but she's never worried she's going to capsize or sink. The kids so far seem more or less to have gotten more of that from her than from me. Jessica has this idea of you are who you choose to be. You are, it's all you. And she thrives on it. It works for her. So my feeling is, give them a shot. If that works for them, good. But if I start to see them shaking apart like I did, I'll be the guy who will say, listen to Papa, you're okay. So that I figure is my role. I will play the I'm Plan B, and I you know too. I think they can't help it. They see me every day. They know what I feel. You know, they hear me talk. They okay, like okay. What the little one, 7, about a year ago we were taking a walk, and she's more temperamental than the other. She gets into, especially the younger sibling, right? She wants the older sibling's attention. If she can't have it willingly, she'll demand it. And so they had an argument, and I had to give the little one a timeout. So we're walking now, and I wanted to let her know, though, that, you know, now that she's calmed down, everything's fine. We're taking a little walk. And she said, you know, Daddy, sometimes I think that I'm a cell. And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, I think I'm a cell, and the world is a body. And I do what the body wants. I just thought, wow, yeah, this daddy girl. Yeah. Woo! Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah.
Mark, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
What a treat. Thank you. Please join us in the lobby.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.